I'm David Forster, and I'm with the BFA, and I have the distinct pleasure of introducing Joel here, Joel Salatin. I think Dan will give some longer remarks later, but I want to say he's an inspiration to me personally. What he's done as a farmer, as an educator, as a community builder at the farm where at Polyphase Farms is really inspiring. I took a pilgrimage there this summer. It's a wonderful place. Unlike many farmers, it's very transparent. You can go walk around the farm unaccompanied, which is really, really a fantastic gift for people. And I urge people to go there. It's in a beautiful part, Shenandoah Valley of Virginia. And so without further ado, Joel.
Okay. Thank you. All right. Good. So we're going to, wow, that came on there, didn't it? So we're going to talk about the people portion of the farm, because you see, I don't believe that there's a single business in the world in which one person has all the gifts and talents necessary to run that business. Now, farms are more than a business for sure, but they are a business. All right. So, let's look at some of my, you know, my basics here. All the gifts and talents to run the farm don't all exist on the same pair of legs. 1 + 1 = 3, okay? And so I'm big on adding people. I would these are just some kind of basic ideas to throw out as we start. I also believe that until you have two salaries from two different generations, you don't have a regenerative business. So every farm that wants to be regenerative has got to be thinking about two salaries from two different generations. And this is a frustration for me, because farmers, you know, we're a really independent cuss, a bunch of, you know, hermit curmudgeon people. And we are fiercely independent, and it's me and Matilda, and we built this and all ourselves, and da-da-da, and I don't want another person, you know, bird-dogging me and fooling around with another person. But you know, all I can tell somebody who doesn't want to be occupied or frustrated with another person, because people skills are not what generally farmers learn to do, all I want you to do is go home and look in the mirror and say, I really want to grow old alone. And if you can look deep in your soul and say, I really want to grow old alone, then have at it, go do your thing. But if that pricks a little, I'm not sure I want to grow old alone, then as Stephen Covey says, we have to start with the end in view, don't we? If we don't want to grow old alone, we can't wait until we're 70 to start bringing on another person. It has to start early, which means we have to think about a business that's bigger than a backyard, a business that actually can support two salaries, multi-generational. We have to be thinking about that in our 30s and 40s and preferably in our 20s. So we can develop the kind of idea that creates multiple salaries. Next, I think wages, hourly wages, are inherently, I don't know if this is a word, but I'm going to use it, and I think you'll get what I'm saying. It's inherently conflict-centric, and that's why we have so much tension between employers and employees. The employer always thinks that the employee is spending too much time jawing at the water fountain, and the employee always thinks the employer is trying to get something for nothing, right? And so there's this tension. And so basically, you know, we at Polyphase now, we have about 20 people, 20 full-time positions involved with the whole operation. You know, it's about a $2.5 million business. And almost nothing, we don't have any employees. Okay, we've got a couple. But basically, we don't have anybody that's hourly wages. Hourly wages are terrible. They're terrible on so many levels. The average 60-year-old farmer is stuck because he can't exit and young people can't enter. So it's difficult. So we got to reduce the hurdles. We've got to reduce the hurdles and make it possible for young people to get in. Old people have all the equity. Young people have the energy. The way tribes built wealth historically was to leverage elderly wisdom on youthful enthusiasm. That's why jet fighter pilots in the military leave early, because the older you get, the less risks you're willing to take. And when you're flying an F-16 fighter jet, you need to be willing to take risks. And so it's the old general sitting back, you know, pushing the ships around, you know, doing the planning, and these invincible 20-year-olds that think they'll never die, they're out taking the risks. And that's a view, that's the way tribal, you know, think about old history, you know, the youth go out and they move stuff around, and when the snowstorm comes, they come to the patriarch who's sitting there, you know, in the tent. And they say, in the blizzard of 1935, where was the place that was warm? And he'll remember. That's how you leverage elderly wisdom on youthful enthusiasm. And the older you get, the less risk, the more risk averse you become, because you don't have enough energy to pick yourself up from failures. Collaboration collapses when there's a different vision, when there are different expectations. Our son Daniel, he says, the number one reason why people don't get along or can't get along or run into problems is unspoken expectations. But I thought you meant, you know, I can't read your mind if you don't tell me. I don't know what you're saying. Right? So you have to put it down. You have to put it down. You have to agree on vision. And that's where the Alan Savory, the single mission statement comes in. You know, so our mission statement is to create agricultural prototypes that are economically, environmentally, and emotionally enhancing and facilitate their duplication throughout the world. Okay? Yours will be something different. Everybody's got a different one. But everybody on the team, everybody on the bus has to agree on it. That means that if you've got a messy and a cleany, you've got to agree on a balance. That means if you have a starter and a finisher, you've got to agree on a balance. You know, the starter, all those unfinished projects sitting out there are just clutter. The starter, well, they're all unfinished gyms. You know, ready, waiting to be, you know, launched. Okay? Introverts and extroverts. Okay? You know, that's one that we deal with. I mean, Teresa and I personally, because I'm the extrovert, in case you didn't know. She's the introvert. Okay? So I love people around. Okay? I mean, the other day, we're sitting there having breakfast downstairs. I see shadows across the window. I look out. Here's a family of four, you know, mom and dad and two kids about 12 and 8, you know. And they're looking in the windows saying, here's where they live. Here's where they live. I look around and say, hi, good morning. Teresa's sitting there. We're eating breakfast. She says, give me the shotgun. I'm going to shoot them. So you have to appreciate that those expectations, those different risks and exposures and those visions, you got to deal with those tensions, okay? And you got to talk them out, and you got to create boundaries and things where everybody is happy. You know, if Teresa were here, she would tell you that there's been days in the last 10 years where she goes and hides in the closet. She got a shirt now, you know, it says like Juan's Landscaping Service, so she can go out and work in the flower bed and people think she's some, you know, Mexican landscaper or something. So we created the Lunatic Tour as a result of conversations to funnel people and steer visitors into certain places. You can have access to us, but here's where it's good. Now, we have a 24/7, 365 open door policy. Anybody can come at any time. But by doing the scheduled lunatic tours, that said, you could come visit the farm anytime, but if you want me, here's the schedule when you can see me. And that created a balance in this thing. So that freed me up, because I'm such a gregarious, I love people so much, I'm such an extrovert, I couldn't bring myself, my emotions, to when somebody comes, to just walk by them and just say hi and keep on walking. Hi, how are you? Where are you from? What are you doing? You know, before you know it, I've spent 15 minutes. And by the end of the day, I've spent 3 hours, haven't gotten anything done. See? So these are all things you have to work through. All right. Nature's template is relationally complex. Multi-speciation, multi-enterprise, multi-people. This idea that the best farm is the farm with the fewest people, and of course now, you know, we're making tractors. You know, we're making tractors without steering wheels and seats on them now. You just steer it with your laptop computer from your farm desk. Okay? And you just plug in the GPS coordinates, it goes out and does everything, plants, plows, harvest, everything, and you never even visit your field. I mean, John Deere's now making, they look really, I have a neighbor, you know, in the ultimate yin-yang, universal cosmos, my immediate neighbor, I mean, this is not a guy that lives up the road, I mean, it's the closest house to our house. He is the Mid-Atlantic representative for Monsanto. Okay? So, I mean, this is the right? Okay. And he's, you know, I went out to get the mail, the newspaper the other morning, and he was driving by, and we stopped, and he stopped and talking, and he'd just gotten back from a conference where he saw tractors with no seats, clutch, steering wheel, nothing. That's a weird-looking tractor. He said, man, I mean, but of course, he thinks this is the, you know, greatest thing since sliced bread. Certainly the greatest thing since GMOs. Anyway, it's nature's template, though, is relationally complex. It is not simplistic and peopleless and simplistic that way. Nature's template is cyclical, okay? When we look at nature's template, it is complex. It is cyclical. There's no waste. It's solar-driven. It's seasonal. It's circular, not linear. It's compulsory. It's compulsory. Has anybody ever run into a frog on the edge of a pond who, if the frog could talk, would look at you and say, you know what? I just don't feel like participating in my world today. You know, no frog ever says that. And so nature's template is participatory. It's symbiotic, synergistic. All players have to play. No player can opt out. Nobody can stomp off into the hissy fit world. And it's connected, okay? It's about networks. It's holistic. It's a web more than a chain. Everything's related to everything. And every resource base, I'm just warming up here. This is just a pre-ramble. Every resource base can be massaged to additional production while increasing the commons. There's not a farm on the planet, yours, mine, anybody else's, there's not a farm on the planet that is fully achieving its leveraging of air, soil, water, community, people, all the resources involved in the commons there. We can grow more vegetation, more hydration, more soil, more people, more income, more diversity, including wildlife. One of my most cherished pieces of paper now is one that Dad and I put together before he died in 1988. He died real young. And before he died, we there in the mid-80s, Teresa and I were just, you know, we'd just come back to the farm full-time September 24, 1982. And about 3 years in, we were just feeling like, I think we're going to make it. I think we're going to make it. And Dad and I sat down on an afternoon and brainstormed how many salaries could come off of the farm. I mean, at the time, Teresa and I were struggling to just, you know, make it ourselves, let alone anybody else. But see, this is the Stephen Covey idea of starting with the end in view. And I still have a little piece of paper in our goals file. It's yellow now. But at that time, on that day, we brainstormed 25 full-time salaries off of our little farm. Now, we're still not there, you know, what, 30 years later. Okay, we're still not there, but we're a lot closer than we were. And if we had come to this, see, if you say to the average farmer, you know, you could actually generate 10 salaries off this place. You know, the average farmer says, what? You know, of course, you got a little tobacco, you know, in the edge of his mouth. What? 10 salaries? I'm already working 80 hours a week. You want me to work 100 hours a week? I can't get it all done anyway. You want me to, you know. They're all thinking about scarcity and not plenty. When Teresa and I got married, we said, thinking about kids, you know, and say, well, you know, what's your dream? I said, my dream is I want to grow old and have the only arguments around being the grandkids fighting over who gets to spend the day with grandpa. That's the way I want to grow old. And you know what? We've got it. See, we've got it. The point is, be willing to dream the depths of your soul and write it down. Because if you don't have an agenda, you will be somebody else's agenda. All right? So how do we do all this? Number one, we brainstorm possible enterprises. Be willing to go back. If you can't imagine it, you won't do it. And when you're brainstorming, nothing is too outlandish. Create a germination platform for fiefdoms. Okay. Now we're getting in a little bit of nitty-gritty here. All right. So the first level of this probably, A, you know, working many farms, most farms, of course, have a couple that's kind of in charge of things. All right. Well, carve out responsibilities. Okay. Don't farm by committee. Carve out spheres of responsibility. That's the beginning of your fiefdoms. All of us want spheres of responsibility. We want to feel needed. We want to have authority and responsibility. We don't want to feel like, you know, somebody's looking over our shoulder every time questioning everything that we're doing. So one of the best things we did in our family as we move forward, and especially as Daniel got married with Sherry, and now there were four of us, was we sat down and actually created physical written job descriptions for each of us. Suddenly now we could make four simultaneous decisions instead of wondering, oh, who's going to counterman me? Am I going to step into their territory? And you know, what we found was there was a lot of inefficiency in stepping in each other's, you know, spot, okay? And so by clarifying whose spots are what, it was good. So one of the things that came out of that was Daniel became day-to-day operations manager. So now when I say Daniel runs the farm and I just run around, it's true. You know, when I get home, he gives me my list. Here's what you got to do before you leave. And I'm home to 2/3 of the time. I never want to lose my farmer's, you know, calluses. I got the farmer's calluses. But that becomes affirming for him, okay, to take the reins of day-to-day operations, and it affirms me as visionary, and I can go, you know, do my little, you know, dream world fantasy stuff and all that. And he calls me when he needs me, which is nice to have your grown son ask you for advice from time to time. So the idea here is rather than creating jobs, we're creating germination platforms for fiefdoms. That starts with the kids. We are big believers that kids should start their own enterprises between 8 and 12 and 11 years old. If you wait till 12, they've already read too much Hollywood, Las Vegas, and Kardashians. You already lost, especially in today's culture. So the time for them to start their business is at about 6, 7, 8, 9 years old, okay, while they're still, you know, excited about life, and they're not calloused with cynicism and contempt, and it's not all ishy. We found that, by the way, the same thing with like butchering animals. If you wait until they're after 12, suddenly it's all ishy. But up until 11, there's no, it's just part of life. And our customers come, they bring their kids out. The customers hide behind the shed, you know. But they want their kids to experience this. But as adults, it's too far out for them, so they send their kids around. We put a knife in their hand, sure, slit some throats. You know, find out that this isn't Bambi. Find out that when things die, they die. They're not like video games where you shoot somebody and you wait a minute and you get new buddies. Life isn't like that. When the chicken is dead, it's dead. When the tomato is dead, it's dead. That's why I'm such a believer in children's gardens. Because folks, this life, this isn't just some fantasy game. This is for all the marbles, right? You know, if we don't change our trajectory, there's not going to be a place for your grandkids to enjoy. Okay? This is serious. Now, I'm not saying we don't have a lot of fun. We do have a lot of fun. All right? But at the same time, if we're going to raise kids and families with common sense, they've got to viscerally participate in the most important things of life. And part of that is learning how to nurture. We don't believe in allowances. Nobody should get paid for breathing. Okay? There are things you do like putting away your dirty clothes and cleaning up your room and washing dishes, and you know, that's part of being a part of humanity. There are things that you do that are simply part of being a part of community. Okay? But when there are special projects and special things to do, pay the kids. All right? And we believed in that. And our, you know, Daniel started his rabbits when he was 8. That always gave him pocket money. I started my chickens when I was 10. That gave me pocket money all through high school and all this stuff. Our daughter, Rachel, started her baking business when she was about 6. You know, girls are always a little more advanced than boys. And so she started this. And you know what that did? When she was, you know, she was about 8 years old, she was down at Farmer's Market, you know. A lady came up to her, you know, one of these blue-haired, you know, coiffed country club ladies that kind of go to the Farmer's Market, you know. And this lady came up and pinched her cheek and said, "Oh, are you the little girl that made the zucchini bread for my garden club last week? The ladies just went ooh and all. That was the best zucchini bread we've ever had." You know what that does to an 8-year-old? That is affirming. And I would much rather be involved with a kid that knows how to grow a tomato or bake a zucchini bread than one that's the top points getter on Angry Birds. And they would too. In truth. So we need to make those opportunities and encourage a germination tray, okay, where they can develop their enterprises. So you brainstorm around. I do a homeschool convention in Virginia about every other year. And one of the things that I do is a seminar on children's entrepreneurism. And in a group like this, I'll ask, and of course, you know, homeschool conventions, they've got tons of homeschoolers all sitting around, and I'll ask for businesses that kids in the room have started, a room like this. I mean, to tell you, it's just one after another, from, you know, pet grooming to walking a dog to, you know, weeding a garden. I mean, kids are full of money-making ideas. And that's not greedy. That's just learning how difficult a profit is, and learning about saving, and learning about having a little bit of money in your pocket to give to someone in need. So it's not just vicariously through mom and dad. See, that's powerful stuff. But when it's their money, they learn stewardship. And so we were really tickled that both of our kids had $20,000 in the bank when they hit 20 years old, and they never got an allowance. Now, that's not $1 million, but it's a pretty good little nest egg, okay? And it's a good start. All right, so a couple things just on working with kids, so they'll want to work with you. This will be worth the conference right here, trust me. Never give time-oriented tasks. Only give task-oriented tasks. How many of you grew up, you know, go practice the piano for 30 minutes. Go weed the green beans for 30 minutes. The problem with time-oriented tasks is that they don't teach efficiency. There's no incentive to be efficient, to be good. You just have to put in your time, okay? In fact, time-oriented tasks actually teach dawdling. So one of the things that I used to do, I still do, one of the ways you can pace yourself, so we're digging post holes. Daniel's, you know, 2 years old. He's got his little Tonka trucks, right? And he goes out, we're going to build a fence, so I'm going to dig post holes, right? And I've got the post hole digger. That's my PhD degree. And I'm digging these post holes. One of the ways I pace myself is I'm not going to take a drink of water until I do two more holes. You know, and you push yourself that way, right? I mean, you do that in exercising, all sorts of stuff. Don't take a break until I reach this, whatever, this benchmark, right? And so, you know, as two-year-olds are wont to do, he's, you know, out here with this, and he starts to whine. Daddy, I'm thirsty. I'm, you know, and the jug's sitting right over there. Sorry, Daniel, you know, we're not going to take a drink until I finish this second fence post, right? So, okay, you know, so you teach this. All right. So when Daniel was about 9 years old, a neighbor family moved in. They had a 9-year-old boy. And so the two boys became fast friends. And, of course, 9-year-old boys, what do they have to do? They have to go build a fort, right? They got 9-year-old boys have to go build a fort. And so they get together and they conspire to build this fort. The moms, of course, pick the date, the play date. And they decide to do it over at the neighbor's place instead of our place. So, okay, the appointed day comes. Daniel goes over to the neighbor's. They're going to build this fort. Well, he's gone about an hour and a half and the phone rings and it's the mom. It's the other kid's mom. And she's saying, what is it with your son? He won't let mine take a drink of water until they finish the first wall of the fort. So when you have tasks, make them performance oriented. Put a survey, pick survey ribbon down the green bean. Say, when you pick to that little survey ribbon, you can quit. That'll be enough. Okay? You don't say go pick beans for 30 minutes. Because then if they just do two plants, there's, all right? There's no, you see what I'm saying? They love competition. Encourage them to compete with you. You know, I'll pick this row. You pick to that ribbon. If you beat me, you know, we'll do something. We'll read a Dr. Seuss book or whatever. But anyway, you do that sort of thing. Okay. And then as we've developed this over time, this has turned into beyond family fiefdoms, okay? So instead of having employees, we have memorandums of understanding. And an MOU is simply a written agreement that specifies what you're going to do, the expectations on you, and the expectations on me, all right? And it defines the terms of the deal. So let me give you a couple of examples, and we're going to go to questions because I could talk about this, you know, all day. There's a lot here to deal with, but so Bree wanted to stay with us. I said, so Bree, you know, how are you going to earn an income? She said, well, I want to be the chef. Well, that pays this much. We have an on-farm chef from May through September when the interns are there, so we can all eat communally, about 25 of us. Now, that's fine. You know, that pays this much. Fine. So she pulls that off of an opportunity sheet, and she says, I'll do that. Good. Well, that's not going to pay a living, so what else are you going to do? She says, well, she has an elementary ed major, loves kids. She says, we don't do school tours. This has been years ago. So we don't do school tours. I'd like to start a school tour program. Okay. So we sit down, and she designs, I name it, but she designs it, the grass stains tours, okay? So these are grass stains tours. They're for school groups. She develops a curriculum. She markets it. She gets almost all the money. We get just a little bit, royalty, and that way it's her business. I don't have to do anything. All I know is if a school bus shows up, well, apparently Bree's got a tour today. I'm free to go about my business. She's completely autonomous to do this. It's her baby. If it doesn't go, it doesn't go. And she's incentivized to perform on it because she's not guaranteed anything if it flops. When our daughter-in-law, Sherry, came along, you know, daughter-in-laws are always a problem because they didn't grow up doing it this way all the time. So they got all these new ideas, you know, these harebrained ideas. Oh, boy, daughter-in-laws, they're a real problem. So we had just started the Metropolitan Buying Clubs. I hope everybody understands I'm having satire. This is fun, okay? All right. We love her to death. In fact, we handpicked her. We told Daniel, this is the one, you know. And he said, what am I looking? You know, he came to me. I mean, can you imagine, you know, a strapping, you know, 19-year-old? And we sat down, and he said, you know, what are we looking for? Well, that's pretty cool, isn't it, you know? So Teresa and I sat down with Daniel, and we wrote it. Here's what we're looking for, you know. We're looking for a gal that can go square dancing on Friday night all gussied up and loves to put her hands gutting a chicken on Saturday morning. Okay? All right, so we found her, Sherry. All right, so they get married. Right about that time, we're starting these metropolitan buying clubs. And Sherry's looking around, you know, for where can I be a part of this? And we don't know if she can do anything. And she says, you know what, I'd like to do the buying clubs. Well, now, you see, a normal business would say, okay, we'll hire you, blah, 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 right? No. If we hired her, what if she was a total flop? What if this was a fairly new, it was only like a year or two old enterprise. What if she couldn't sell? What if she couldn't do anything? Fortunately, she had enough personal confidence to say, don't guarantee a penny. I'll work on commission. So we have an MOU with her, an agreement. She works on straight commission. Now, at the time, the sales were so tiny. I mean, she was only getting like $50. Okay? But in 11 years, she has grown that to $1 million business and now gets a nice big commission that's hers. She built it. It's her claim to fame. She is the Metropolitan Buying Club marketing guru. Okay? So Jonathan wanted to stay with us. He was an apprentice. He said, I want to stay with you. All right, so I said, Jonathan, how are you going to make a living? Are you hearing a refrain here? In other words, I'm not responsible. You're responsible to tell me within our framework how you're going to make a living. Boy, you know how much pressure that takes off of the owner to not feel like I have to make you a salary? Instead, you bring a proposal to me with your salary and say, I'm gonna put skin in the game here. All right. So Johnson said, I wanna stay. What are you gonna do? He said, I wanna run one of the rental farms, and I wanna run a herd of cows, a pair of egg mobiles, raise 4,000 broilers, one set of turkeys. I'll do two. I'll take over the pig thing with four groups of pigs, and because he had big, you know, I want to make a lot of money. He said, and I want to be your shop foreman. I want to take over the shop. Now, we've never had a shop foreman before. And I said, and Jonathan, you got to understand, Daniel and I, you know, look, I fix things, but I reluctantly fix things, okay? I weld, I fabricate, I do stuff, but I'm not going to rebuild an engine, okay? We do stuff because we have to. My welds are okay, but they're not, you know, they're not pretty. Jonathan, I mean, he'd rather work in the shop than eat, okay? And when he was an apprentice, I mean, at 2 o'clock in the morning, the lights would be on out in the shop, and he's out there knocking around, you know, fixing things. And that's pretty neat to have an on-farm mechanic, you know, a guy that can fix and fabricate and weld and build everything we want. That's pretty cool. And so we worked out a deal, developed a business. So his business is Farm Fix. Okay, that's the name of his business, Farm Fix. And he invoices out of us, out of our own shop, for his time, just like any repair shop in town. Again, he's not an employee. The checks go to Farm Fix, okay, as an LLC. Now, here's the thing that's important to realize. For 50 years, the pliers have been hanging on this wall. Suddenly, Jonathan wanted to hang on this wall. And I had to be okay with that. See, there's no free lunch, folks. There's no free lunch. We talk about delegation. We talk about, you know, inspiring and encouraging other people. And then when the rubber hits the road, we really want it all ourselves. Right? And so what I got out of it was a shop foreman. The first time in my life, I can go out and break stuff, bring it in, pick something else up, and go out and break it while he's fixing that. And it's fixed better and faster than I can fix it. Okay? And so on our rental farms and on our own place, what we've got then is essentially we see ourselves as a germination tray in which young people can come and develop their own fiefdoms and cherry pick from a list. And if they see something they want to do that's not on the list, so by doing time and motion studies, we've broken up everything we do into its value. How much is maintaining a group of pigs worth a day? How much is moving a group of cows worth a day? How much is raising a chick from here to here a day? And so the beauty of this is that they can cherry pick. It's not anarchy, because if you want cows, you have to run egg mobiles, because everybody wants cows. So if you're going to run cows, you have to have egg mobiles. Otherwise, they might not take egg mobiles because some of these guys might not want to put away eggs. Okay? So it's not anarchy. It's within a parameter that is guaranteed to be symbiotic for the land, for the ecology of the land. But in doing so, we also create something that is symbiotic for the ecology of the relationships. Because now, instead of having a bunch of employees, instead, what we have are a bunch of self-powered fiefdom stakeholders who bring to the table their own interests, their own gifts, their own talents, and they can build and create their businesses. And over the years, we've launched numerous young farmers who've come through the program. They stay with us a couple of years, 3 years, and then they get enough confidence. See, it takes time to build enough confidence to go out and be on your own. And this way, they don't crash and burn, because now they go out with enough experience, confidence, connections, gives them time to develop some connections where they want to be, okay? And actually look at things instead of being, jump off the cliff, immersed, and then crash and burn in a couple of years. Okay? That's all I'm going to say about that. I'm going to go to question and answer now, because there's a million things we can talk about. So I'm going to let you drive the conversation here. Here till we're, 4:15 or something like that? How long do we go? 4:15. Okay. So we got 20 minutes, lots of time for questions. So let's just continue the conversation. What's on your mind? What's unclear to you? What do you think? Don't be bashful.
And I'll come around with the microphone, one of us, so if y'all can hold on to your question until the microphone
comes. Okay. Hannah, is that right?
Yes, Hannah and Peggy.
All right. I'll let you guys be the bad guys, and whoever you recognize will be the person that, not who I recognize, who you put the microphone to. All right? So, first question. Yes.
How do you come up with the opportunity sheet, and how do you decide whether they get to pick what they want to create as a program versus them picking off the opportunity sheet?
Okay, great question. All right, so the opportunity sheet is essentially all of the farm enterprises. For us, cows, pigs, broilers, egg layers, what else? Turkeys, okay? Oh, no. People cleaning the bathrooms, no. You do that because you're a part of humanity, okay? Nobody gets paid for cleaning the bathroom, okay? That's what you do because life is full of poop. It's just what you do, all right? So, no. These are enterprises. These are enterprises, okay? And there are some that don't get done. For example, when Dan came, he wanted to start a shiitake mushroom enterprise. Great. So he did a shiitake mushroom enterprise. He was there for 2 years. He and his wife, they had a couple kids. They wanted to go back to Wisconsin, where both of their families were from. Understandably, we're all grandparents. And, that's one of the problems of dealing with young people. They're transient. It's hard to hang on to them. But we get that. So he left. So shiitake mushrooms is on the sheet. Well, nobody stepped up to claim that one. So guess what? We don't do shiitake mushrooms. And we got to be okay with that. The point is, now the farm becomes not just a manifestation of my interests. It becomes a cumulative manifestation of all the people and the interests that we have, which are way more than me. So if there's something that's not on the sheet, for example, Eric, I always feel like a televangelist with these things. So Eric... He saw sugar maples around, untapped. Well, Daniel had tapped him when he was a little kid. That was one of his little childhood enterprises, and we got him a stainless steel, pan, and he read up on it and did this as his business. And then as he got older, his interest kind of faded. He got busy with other things, managing things, and so it kind of went by the wayside. Eric sees the pan sitting up in the rafters of the barn. What's that? Oh, that's a maple sugar, Anyway, he says, I want to do that. So now he's tapping, and he's last year, I think he got 20 gallons of maple syrup. He taps on us and the neighbors. Now, we're not in, hot maples like up here. You say 20 gallons is nothing, but it's a couple $1,000s. And so what we see is you build your compensation package not from one thing, but from this, and this. And eventually you develop. You put together a package, okay? And I could tell you this year a couple of these packages These guys, one of them is going to earn $70,000. One's going to earn $50,000. These are first-time farmers, first year, and they go from zero to full-time farm employment in a day, tapping into our marketing umbrella, okay? And they get to tap into our community, our tractor, our infrastructure, our experience. I mean, like several years ago, we had this derecho, the straight line 80-mile-an-hour wind. I mean, several people died in the community. Power was out. We had 100 degrees. Power was out for a week. I mean, it was really, you might have read about it. Came down, you know, and we were right in the nexus of it. We were in the worst. Like, we had neighbors that died, you know, killed. Okay. And so it was a big deal. Well, one of our subcontractors on one of these rental farms had a pair of Eggmobiles that got flipped uphill. And they were sitting on a hill like this, and they flipped upside down uphill on the roof. Well, he goes out in the morning. He's a new farmer. I mean, can you imagine? He's in shock. I mean, he looks at that. I mean, it's one of those things you look at. You know, your first year on a farm, and you're paralyzed, right? Okay, you know, that paralysis. He picks up the phone, calls. So Daniel creates a triage sheet. Within 3 hours, he's over there with generator, all our hand tools, basically a portable shop, tractor, chain, four-wheel drive. And in 2 hours, as we say, the cavalry descended. And in 2 hours, they're upright. The roof's back on. The chickens are happy laying eggs. It's all done in 2 hours. What's that worth as a beginning farmer? A lot, okay? And so that's what you tap into. So you can bring stuff that doesn't exist, and you can pick from this opportunity that does exist. So we have everything from soap to whatever. We had this year, this is going to be really fun. We're really excited about this coming year because one of our interns last year, she wanted to stay. I said, well, what do you want to do? She says, I really want to do a full-time garden and CSA. We've never had a CSA. We've never really sold vegetables. Well, guess what? She's there, and she's doing a full Elliott Coleman four-season harvest. But guess what she was able to do? She's already got a market because we've got 6,000 customers and 50 restaurants. So she's already got a built-in market. And she came to me. She says, I want to make these tents like Elliott has, you know, with plastic on the outside, Remay on the inside to get you, you know, whatever, 40 degrees of, anyway, you know, all that stuff. And she said, I need some boards. Fine. We've got a sawmill. We got logs sitting there. I went out in 2 hours. I gave her custom. She gave me the dimensions, a cut sheet. And in 2 hours, I had her a whole stack of perfectly cut milled boards for her to build her tents out of. You know, so this community collaboration of being able to tap into infrastructure, expertise, resources, all that stuff. And these young people, since they all come through our program as interns and apprentices, they all know stuff, and so if somebody's got to be gone for a week in the summer, you know, a wedding, I mean, they are young people, friends are getting married, you know, all this stuff, or, you know, or grandmothers are dying, you know, those kinds of things, all right, well, they can be gone, and they cover for each other. What's that worth to a farmer, especially a livestock farmer, to know that a call away is four people who can come and babysit so I can be gone on emergency for 3 or 4 days? It's a big deal. Good. I'm sorry. I'm not supposed to pick.
Before I ask my question, I just wanted to tell you I quote you almost daily. Mm. I'm very OCD, and I quite often say, good enough.
Good enough.
Sometimes good enough.
Good enough is perfect.
I say it all the time. My question is, on these entrepreneurs, how do you determine what your cut as overhead is?
The question is, how do we determine what our cut as overhead is? All right. So, the opportunity sheet is essentially a result of us doing time and motion studies. And well, what are time and motion studies? All right, you go out to the field with a watch and you time different procedures. What is the labor cost of moving 500 chickens? What's the labor cost of taking care of 1,000 chicks in a brooder? Nailed down to a chick cost per day, okay? Did you know that McDonald's has a test kitchen where everything is on wheels? And I had an attorney come and visit. He was the McDonald's attorney in D.C., 12 or so years ago, a long time ago. This guy came, and he was the front man for McDonald's. They were looking at starting and offering a grass-finished hamburger in McDonald's. And some executives wanted to come and see me, but they were afraid I'd bite their heads off based on some of the things that I've said. And so they sent this attorney to come and, you know, kind of feel things out. And had a delightful morning with him. And this is what he told me. He said, we have this test kitchen. Everything's on wheels. Everybody goes in every day, and we move stuff. I mean, sometimes no more than an inch, okay? Or we make, you know, a curve out of a straight line, or a straight line out of a curve, or a 90 degree out of, are you with me? You know, so everything's on wheels. The cash register, the fat fryer, the refrigerators, everything's on wheels. He said, if we can figure out how to shave half of a second off of a routine procedure, that's worth $10 million to us. All right. That's what I call time and motion. Okay? So you've got to figure out all, so we break down our different enterprises and the components of those enterprises and say, what is each of that, what are those things worth? Okay? Now, there are some things that we have options where you can actually own it. Like, for example, broilers. Okay? I mean, that's a pretty rapid, you can buy the chick, buy the feed. All right? So we load the compensation package to reward your ownership. Because some of these people come with a nest egg that they want to invest, and some don't come with a penny. And so if you want to come and you want to own the birds and you want to run it, you know, as your enterprise, own the birds, buy the feed, process the birds, and basically put them in our freezer in a bag, then we pay you X amount. But if all you want to do, if you want us to own the birds, us to buy the feed, us to process the birds, then you just get a caretaker's amount. Okay? And we load it to encourage the risk taker. Because here's the deal. If you, through negligence, lose a bunch of birds, if they're our birds, there's tension there. Because we can always say, well, you weren't taking care of business. Or if we see a bunch of wasted feed on the field, that's our feed, not your feed. All right? But those kind of things, if you own it, there's no tension there. So that's why we load it. The other thing about this is it's all, look, so we pay $35 a day, for example, for moving a herd of cows, whether it's 100 or 400 cows. All right, same deal, front fence, back fence, water, mineral. All right, okay. If you forget the pliers because you're thinking about, you know, Friday night's movie or Saturday night's hot date, there's tension there. If we were paying you by the hour to watch you have to go out, oh, I forgot the pliers. Now you come back with our four-wheeler, our gas, spend an extra half hour to find the pliers and go back out of the field, and you're on the clock. That's tension. But if we pay by the task, you can go out and lie all afternoon smelling butterflies as far as we're concerned, and that's fine. Are you with me? You see how this fundamentally changes the relationship? Okay? And it moves it from personal responsibility, it moves it toward personal responsibility from entitlement.
So people, you're paying them as if, like the shiitake mushroom.
You pay
them as if that was a task?
No, on a shiitake mushroom guy, he established his shiitake mushroom price. We already have, yeah, on our land. I mean, I gave him the wood. I mean, that's something that I can do. Why? I mean, I'm happy to have another enterprise on the farm, okay? So I got these trees that are diseased and crooked, and well, they need to come down anyway. So I can give him that.
He's made money on your farm. Did you get a cut of that? Or?
I got a cut of it two ways. One is when he's going to sell those shiitake mushrooms through our marketing channel. So if they're sold in a retail store, we get a 30% cut. If they're sold to the restaurants, the marketer gets a commission, and the weight, shiitake mushrooms are not a good thing to talk about weight, but anyway, you get the idea. The weight adds to the distribution fee because we don't bury our distribution in the product. All of our distribution, there's a per pound charge to the customer that's a separate line item. So anything else that we can add to the truck helps us pay our gas bill, driver's salary, blah, blah, blah. And our driver's salary, yes, he has a minimum salary, but he also has a benchmark. Every pound above that benchmark, he gets a bonus. We gross share on every pound above that benchmark, above that salary point. So we try, every single person, we try to build in, even if it is a salary and there's no hourly wages, zero, okay? It's either salary or total commission. But even on a salary, we want a commission component in order to incentivize creativity and thinking outside the box. Great. Okay, good. Another question. Got about 6-7 minutes. What else?
Joe, how do you deal with the brand that you've established? So this is Polyface. It has a certain level of expectation in the market. You get somebody who comes in who may not be producing a product that is Polyface quality.
Right.
How do you address that?
Okay, how we address that is nobody can become a subcontractor or a collaborator unless they've come through our intern program. So that becomes our vetting program for who even gets to participate in this germination tray. Okay? So internship is our boot camp, so to speak. All right, think about the military, that you come in at a boot camp level and then you can go on from there. But if you flunk out of the boot camp level, or if that procedure shows that you're not a person that's a good fit for us, then you don't get to pick these things. I mean, we only work with people we like to work with, okay? And if we had that kind of question, we wouldn't work with you, okay? So the time, the vetting time, working closely together gives us, you know, a sense of spirit, attitude, and all that stuff, you know, that helps. The other thing is that you have to understand then that the people that are wanting to tap into this have to be entrepreneurial self-starters as well. Because if you just want to punch a time clock and work for demand, this isn't going to satisfy you, being out there and not getting paid for smelling the butterflies. And are you with me? That's not going to satisfy you. You want a guarantee, and you're going to tend to not go back out there if you've got a fox in the chickens to do night duty, you know, with night vision goggles and deal with the. Are you with me? You know, we want people that have shared skin in the game. That's who we're looking for. And if you're not willing to put shared skin in the game, we don't want you. Now, the downside of that is entrepreneurs tend to want to work for themselves. So, you know, we sit around. The thing that's frustrating to us about this is that the young people who stay, by definition, because they're entrepreneurial, tend to want to go out and do their own. They don't want to, the good ones, you know. I mean, because we'd love for some of these young people to stay forever, you know, good ones, right? But we've inherently vetted away from people who are satisfied, and nobody leaves because they're unsatisfied. And we've had people, goodness, you know, very, but they, you know, they've got family dreams, you know, they got other things to do, okay? And so it's just the way it is, and we just have to be happy with it. It's just the way it is. We're just glad we got you for 2 years, you know, or whatever, all right? That's how we look at it. Yes.
You had expounded on the time and motion studies a little bit, and you also mentioned that there was someone that worked as a mechanic that sort of invoiced separately. Is that sort of the way that you look at these things, where the farm will value labor, but you'll let the market value the more skilled operations like a mechanic or veterinary skills or other things like this?
It's a great question. Okay, so for example, we know we have benchmarks on routine procedures. For example, one person should move a chicken shelter every 60 seconds. That's a benchmark. Okay, now I can do it in about 40, but I don't expect everybody to hit my benchmark. So we have a conservative benchmark. Put away 30 dozen eggs in 30 minutes. I can do it in 20. The benchmark is 30. Eviscerate a chicken. All right. I can do it sustained once every 30 seconds. Our benchmark is every 45 seconds. Okay. So we have benchmarks. That way, we can establish an amount. And our routine amount is $20 an hour. So once you have your time, then you allot a $20 an hour amount to it. And if you want to make it 25 or if you want to make it 15, I don't care how you set your, but at some point you've got to decide, what's this labor worth? All right. And then you tie the labor to the time, to the benchmark, then you can create a value for that procedure. Then you can actually subcontract or farm that procedure out. Okay. Because now you have, you know, you have a value. Is that okay?
I think this will be our last question.
So how do you then tie that back to, say you're doing like going out and moving the cattle, for example, and it's $35 to move the cattle. But how does that tie back to all the costs of the cattle operation and the money that, you know, that you net at the end of the year or the end of 2 years or however long?
Yeah, fair enough. Okay, so all of your procedures, you know, you have infrastructure, you have inventory, you have expenses, fuel, feed, mineral, are you okay? Veterinarian, okay? So you have all these costs. One of those line items is labor. Now you see, most farmers don't even have a labor line item, right? I mean, you just do all this, and then you hope at the end of the year there's enough left to live on, right? But one of the nice things about this procedure is we actually have a line item for labor. And so that simply becomes part of the deals. And why did we come up with $35 for moving cows? Because at $20 an hour, that's an hour and a half, plus a little, okay? Plus your gas to run over there, okay? And so so our benchmark is 1 hour per herd of cows. That's our benchmark. So we give it a little bit of cushion, conservative, and go to an hour and a half, all right, at $20 an hour. We're back to the $20 an hour. Okay? So you have a standard, and you work with that. You have to realize, though, too, for example, in Jonathan with the shop, realize that he set his rate. We didn't set his rate. He set his rate. Now, if he'd have been, you know, if we thought that he was going to say $50 an hour, we wouldn't have had him. We're back to your, you know, but we knew Jonathan well enough. We knew he wasn't going to do it because he wanted to make, so he had a lot of reasons to be conservative so I don't scare him off, right, in the negotiations. And we had that protection that we were willing to jump off the cliff knowing that he was going to be conservative. And remember, he got a built-in business and a built-in shop, okay? And he's using our welder, you know, our grinder, our electricity, our, okay? And so it's not fully like a shop, but this is what you sit down and you negotiate. You say, well, you know, we'll give a little, you give a little, you know, and you come out to your thing. So the kind of procedure I'm describing in some ways, it's more complicated. Instead of just having, you know, $15 an hour, do this job and you get paid this. You know, that's very, very simple in some ways. What I'm describing is a little more complex. But I'll tell you what I'm describing, once there's a high level of trust and a clear expectation and a shared vision, it runs so much easier because now it runs as a self-employed, self-powered entrepreneur as opposed to these guys showing up on my doorstep, or what do you want me to do today? Okay. Now suddenly this whole thing runs like a smooth oiled machine, and all we have to do are massage relationships. Now that's not always easy, okay, because sometimes it's a patent place, and I get it. All right. And so we spend a lot of time making sure everybody's happy, everybody knows what's going on, visioning. We once a week all of our subcontractors come to the farm for the familial farm dinner once a week to keep them in the loop so they know the interns and apprentices and solidify these relationships. So that's, you know, that's another, you know, 10 meals a week that we pay for at $10 a plate, but that keeps them in the loop. And and keeps them excited about the big picture, okay? And so there's no free lunch, and we've just decided that it's much better to invest in people that are self-empowered and motivated to run with our vision than it is to be this corporate top-down dependency, this codependency thing, and this constant tension that when you're neglectful or you're fooling around, and we see that, where there's this little bit of resentment every time when we see that. Instead, you know, if it takes you 3 hours to move the cows because you're a novice and you don't know very much, well, it takes you 3 hours. And you have to have the savvy to realize our benchmark is an hour, and so it's up to you to figure out how to make it an hour so that you actually turn this into a paying deal, all right? It's not our responsibility. It's your responsibility to step up to the benchmark and achieve that benchmark. Okay? The beauty of this, and I'll close, is that now suddenly, we can bring partners to the business without being responsible for their salary. Do you know how liberating that is? When I talk about, at the start, when I said you don't have a regenerative business until you have two salaries, the average person says, I can hardly pay myself, let alone two people. We ain't gonna get two. This is crazy. This way, you bring on shared risk takers and stakeholders, like on the marketing end. I'm not going to pay you a penny, but I'll pay you a commission on everything you sell. Now, I'll go out here and farm. You do the marketing. We both win. 1 + 1 = 3. That's what you get when you actually empower other people with their fiefdoms. Okay? You ready to go build fiefdoms? Yeah. All right.